Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So we're reading in Book 2, Canto 10, The Kingdoms and Godheads of the Little Mind. We read about these three levels of mind, the physical mind, hammering at fact and form, the vital mind, the burning spirit of desire, and last of the three, the power of reason. About reason, it starts on page 249. We read to the end of the canto from there, and then we went back here to the middle of page 249 and started to look more closely at Sri Aurobindo's description of the reason. And we reached page 251, line 473, her sciences, precise and absolute. So we'll move on from there. You'd like to start, Patty?
Her sciences, precise and absolute, on the huge bare walls of human nations, written round nature's deep, dumb hieroglyphs. She pens in clear, demotic characters, the vast encyclopedia of her thoughts, an algebra of her mathematics signs, her numbers and unerring formulas. She builds to clinch her summary of things. On all sides, runs as if in a cosmic mosque, tracing the scriptural verses of her laws, the daedal of her patterned arabesque, art of her wisdom, artifice of her lore. This art, this artifice, are her only stock.
Thank you. So this is reason, and it's as if human nescience, our not knowing, is a vast structure with huge bare walls. There on those walls, what we see is the huge dumb hieroglyphs of nature, the data, the impressions, the images that nature gives us. But to us they are hieroglyphs originally, to humanity. They're written in a kind of secret language. But reason takes hold of that, those dumb hieroglyphs, and around them she writes in clear demotic characters. Demotic, that's the language of the people. We can all understand. So, of course, it was a great moment in the history of languages when they discovered in Egypt something called the Rosetta Stone, on which there was a lengthy inscription in hieroglyphs, in that sacred, secret, priestly writing of the Egyptians. But then they realized the same text written in Greek demotic that anybody could understand. So, yes, please, Jean-Yves.
There are three languages. Please correct.
Yes.
Hieroglyph, Egyptian demotic, and Greek.
And the Greek. Thank you, Jean-Yves. Yes. So suddenly that opened up a way to interpret the great dumb hieroglyphs that are written all over the walls of Egyptian temples and tombs and figures. Big step forward. So in a way, this is what reason does for us. She gives us a key to understanding nature in terms that we can grasp. So using a language that we feel we can understand and use ourselves, reason gives us the vast encyclopedia of her thoughts and the algebra of her mathematics signs. Algebra, of course, is also a mathematical language that if we can understand it, it's the key to understanding many aspects, not only mathematics, but the world around us. It's the secret of the Veda. We hear about Vedic mathematics, but I really don't know how it works. I'm also mathematically illiterate, I have to confess. So anyway, reason interprets to us the numbers and the unerring formulas. No? And she uses all these, reason uses all these things to clinch, to fasten up tightly and securely her summary of things. She doesn't give us an entirely detailed account, but a summary of things. So for us here in the midst of nature, with the help of reason, it's as if we are in a mosque, cosmic mosque, a mosque of the whole universe. And in a mosque, there will be written very, very beautifully in mosaics or painting on the walls, in this beautiful Arabic calligraphy, there will be messages, messages from the divine. So she, it's as on all sides, runs as if in a cosmic mosque, tracing the scriptural verses of her laws. That's what's usually written on the walls of a mosque, the verses from the Quran, the didal of her patterned arabesques. A didal is a border, a decorative border around the top of a wall. So in the mosque, that's what we have. And it can be very, very intricate. And arabesque is an adjective that has been coined in European languages to speak about this beautiful kind of calligraphy and curving and geometrical designs that are typical of Islamic art. This is the art of the wisdom and the artifice, the artificial product of her lore, of her learning. And then he says, this art and this artifice are the only stop of reason. So he will explain himself more fully in the next lines. It is a labyrinth. Daedalus was the engineer who created the labyrinth in Crete to imprison the Minotaur, this bull-headed monster. But in architecture, if I'm not wrong, it has come to mean this kind of decorated border. Am I right, Helmut? Yeah. And particularly in Greek art, that border, it looks a bit like a labyrinth. And maybe in the mosques, it's even more labyrinthine and complicated to follow.
And in a mosque, you cannot have the image of human.
You shouldn't have the images of anything in nature, no? Yes. Please, Don. Yes.
Cunningly skillful in artistic imagination, maze
like. Like a maze, like a labyrinth. Yeah. Yes. Yes, what does Chambers say?
He says that a mystical artist who constructed the Cretan labyrinth.
Mythical, a mythical artist, or engineer he was really, who constructed the Cretan labyrinth, yes. But this adjective from his name, from Daedalus, yes, gets used in different contexts. Like,
Intricate,
yeah.
Cunningly skillful.
Yeah, that's the idea, yeah. But also decorative. But here when he uses it, how does he use it? As of on the cosmic moss. The didal of her patterned arabesques. Yes, it's this decorative border around the top of the wall. 483.
Here it's a noun.
Here, Sri Aurobindo is using it as a noun, yes. And it is used as a noun in this sense of a decorative board. So who's next? Would you like to read?
The art, this artifice, are her only stop in her high works, pure intelligence, in her withdrawal from the senses trap. There comes no breaking of the walls of mind. There leaps no rending flesh of the absolute.
Continue, please.
There dawns no light of heavenly certitude. A million faces wears her knowledge here, and every face turned to the doubt. All now is questioned, all with once monumental in their massive crowd.
Continue to this. Yes, yeah, sorry.
Her old great music writings disappear, and into their place start strict ephemeral signs. This constant change spells progress to her eyes. Her thought is an endless march without a goal. There is no summit on which she can stand and see in a single glance the infinities whole.
There we'll stop. Full stop. Indentation. So this is the limitation of reason. She gives us these clear demotic characters that help us to understand the world around us, but it is really limited. If I go back to line 486, in her high works of pure intelligence, in her withdrawal from the senses trap. This is one of the things that reason can do. Pure reason is not forced to depend on the data we get from our senses. Pure reason can go higher than that and work out all kinds of things, knowledge, understanding, that isn't available directly from sense experience. But even so, there comes no breaking of the walls of mind. She works still within the limitations of the mind. Into reason, there leaps no rending flash of absolute power, some wonderful intuitive revelation. No? There dawns no light of heavenly certitude. Her knowledge here wears a million faces. We can prove all kinds of things by reason and understand and read all different kinds of conclusion. But all of them, he says, are wearing this turban, this in the form of a question mark, no? Of doubt. Reason can't alone cannot give us absolute certitude. So all now is question, all reduced to naught, to nothingness. Once monumental in their massive craft, her old great mythic writings disappear. He spoke earlier on about the power of myth, how illuminating that can be to us at a certain stage of the development of our understanding. But when we rely on reason, then they disappear. And instead, what we have are her strict signs, the algebraic, mathematical, rational signs of reason. And this constant change, people who really believe in reason, they think this means progress. Yeah. But her thought is not really leading anywhere. It's an endless march without a goal. There's no summit, no high point on which reason can base herself firmly and spread light all over the world, and see in a single glance the whole infinite universe. You had something, Don?
Yeah, it's a little strange. On line 696, and in their place are strict, very strict, but yet
ephemeral signs.
Yeah. Not steady, not stable.
It means that we believe in them for a time, and then we move on to something else. He's being paradoxical again, yeah, using these contradictory words. So now he's going to tell us some more about reason.
This is what happens with science, actually. Once the science says this, and 40 years or 100 years,
they've come to a different conclusion. Yes, exactly. Would you like to read next? Line 501. Inconclusive.
Is reason's toilet. Each strong idea can use her as its tool. Accepting every grief, she keeps her case. Open to every thought, she cannot know. The eternal advocate, seated as judge, armors and logics invulnerable mail. Combatants for truth, real throne, and set on a high horse black back of argument. Filled forever with a wordy lance in a mock tournament where none can win. The her rigid balance, she sits on white and empty air, cool and pure in her impartial poise. Absolute her judgment seems, but not sure. Time cancels all her verdicts in appeal.
Thank you. All this hard work of the reason, reason's toil, is inconclusive. It doesn't come to a final conclusion. Every strong idea that comes up can use reason as its tool. No? And reason allows this. She accepts every brief. A brief is what you give to a lawyer. You go to a lawyer and you tell him, look, I've got this and this problem and I want you to represent my case, and it's like this. This is what I have to say. And if you pay him his fee, he will argue your brief. He will not think about what is really the truth of the matter. You are his client. He will argue your case. No?
He takes every case. Hmm? He takes every case.
Yes, yes, right. Yes. Yeah. Accepting every brief, she pleads her case. She doesn't discriminate between the value of them. She's open to every thought. But because of that, she can't really know. She's like an eternal advocate. An advocate is that lawyer who's putting forward the brief. No? If the advocate is seated as the judge, no, he will give this invulnerable armor of logic to the case. You know, nobody will be able to prove him wrong. No? But that armor, he will lend it to 1,000 different warriors who are fighting for truth's veiled throne. They all are arguing and saying, I should sit on the throne of truth. I've got the truth. But if all they've got to go on is reason and logic, they're all actually equally unable to prove their case. They are like combatants in one of those old tournaments, medieval tournaments, riding on horseback with your lance, tilting. It was called tilting because what you wanted to do was to tilt your opponent, push him off his horse, to tilt forever. His lance, his weapon, is words. And this is only a mock tournament. None of those combatants can win. She's an assayer. An assayer is somebody who finds out the value of something. She's assaying thoughts, values, with her rigid tests. Usually these tests are chemical tests to find out whether it's pure gold or silver or something else. No? So there she is, just like that image of truth, sitting balanced with her balance and her sword and blindfold, no? Like justice. She sits on a wide and empty air, aloof and pure in her impartial poise. She's not leaning to one side or the other, treating everything equally. Her judgments seem to be absolute, but none of them is sure. Time cancels all her verdicts in appeal. The judge has given a judgment. You can always appeal. And after some time, as Turiya said, time cancels the verdict. New information comes, new ways of seeing things come. So all those absolute judgments get cancelled in appeal. Yes?
Can I read a quote about being reasonable by mother?
Yes, please.
Finally, you do not grow anymore by growing reasonable. You stop growing altogether.
That's it.
Because
you consider your judgments are absolute.
However, if you're into an infrational stage, then rational is better than absolute.
Yes, right. Yes. Yeah, that, we can also quote Mother on that.
Yeah.
No? Yes.
Did you say that?
Until you have that higher kind of intuition, which is absolutely sure, please don't leave your reason.
Yes.
Because then you will be in danger of becoming one of those irrational beings of whom there are far too many already in the world. So yes, for us human beings, reason is a great light. But here he's showing us how it is not a perfect light, that there's a higher light. We need that flash from above to give us the higher light.
The cause of wars, too.
Everybody can justify. Yeah. All quarrels are like that. Naren, you would read?
Although like sunbeams to a low-bound mind, her knowledge fails to fall from clear heaven. Its rays are lantern lusters in the night. She throws a glittering robe on ignorance, but now has lost her ancient sovereign claim to rule mind's higher land in her absolute right. Bind thought with logics or forged infallible chain, or see the truth new in a bright abstract gaze. A master and slave of star phenomena, she travels on roads of erring sight, or looks upon a set of mechanical world constructed for her by her instruments. A bullock yoke in the cart of proven fact, she drags huge knowledge base through matter's dust. To reach utility's immense bazaar, apprentice she has grown to an old drudge, and aided sense in her seeking's arbiter. And now she uses as a assayer's stone. As if she knows not facts are husks of truth. The husk she keeps, the kernel throws aside.
Thank you. So this is Sri Aurobindo's critique of materialist science, the kind of reasoning which is tied to sense data. He says it's become like that. We use the reason only in this very practical way. And because of that, her claim, her ancient sovereign claim to rule mind's high realm in her absolute right, she's lost that because she's not using reason in its highest way. But still, to us, with our glowworm mind that has only a very faint light, like one of those little insects in the night, her knowledge feigns, pretends to fall from a clear heaven, from a clear sky of knowledge. In fact, the rays are like a lantern, the light of a lantern in the night, relatively bright, but not very. So what reason is doing is on our ignorance, it's covering it with a glittering robe. But we have to remember that all that glitters is not gold. No, it's not necessarily gold. It's not necessarily the light of the sun of truth. So in that way, she has lost her ancient sovereign claim to rule mind's high realm in her own absolute right, that she's the highest power. Her claim to bind thought with logic's forged infallible chain, fixed chains, step by step. Logical rule. It's a very useful tool, but still, it doesn't show us the truth. And even if she uses that logic and that power of reason for abstract thought, it's still not reliable. And particularly now, reason in the modern age has become not only a master, but the slave of phenomenon, of physical facts. So reason is traveling on roads of erring sight. It gives some power of vision, but it's not reliable. She looks upon a set mechanical world constructed for her by her instruments. That's what her instruments tell her. Her instruments, first of the senses, and then of these tools which we devise for ourselves to extend the scope of our senses. So she's no longer this high angel seated on empty air. She's more like a bullock, yoked in the cart of proven fact, dragging huge knowledge bales, huge bundles of knowledge through matter's dust. And where is she going? To reach utility's immense bazaar, this marketplace where the only value is usefulness. The senses used to be her drudge, her servant, humble servant, but now she's become an apprentice to her old drudge. An aided sense is what decides, is the arbiter of her seeking, tells her whether it's right or wrong. This sense is what she uses as the assayer's stone. It's a stone we can use to test the whether it's really gold or not.
Before to assay, you said it's balancing, huh?
What?
Before to assay.
No, assaying means to establish the value of something. An assayer, he's somebody who finds out whether it's really gold or silver or not. Maybe I said something else about the balancing.
I didn't get the part about the old drudge.
The old drudge is the senses, the body. So the physical or the physical mind or the, you know.
So reason has become an apprentice.
To physical.
Physical.
As if she knew not. Actually, the reason does know that facts are only husks. They're only the hard shell of truth. They are not the kernel, they're not the really good, valuable bit that's inside. But in modern science, they keep the husks, the outside appearances, no? and throws away kernel, the really nourishing part. The really valuable part, which is within, covered by that husk.
Which is pretty much governed by the things of the senses.
Right, that's what...
As the base of science.
Of what we can call materialistic science, yeah, which, as we mentioned another day, has actually become a kind of religion. It's not any longer a field of open, free, dispassionate inquiry. There are certain dogmas that if you don't follow those, if you reach different conclusions, then you're not regarded as a real rational scientist at all. You know, you may not be allowed to publish, you may lose your job if you're willing to look beyond the husks and find something else. Yes, Jean-Yves.
An aided sense is a seeking arbiter.
So we don't only use our physical senses. We use our measuring rods and probes and lenses and all these kind of things. But whatever, so the sense is aided. But whatever we find out with these extensions of our physical senses, we consider to be the arbiter, the one who decides the value of our research, yeah, our seeking. I mean, not we, them. We, the modern human materialistic mind. It's already changing. Yeah.
About this scanner. This week we have seen in Cinema Paradiso scientific movies.
Yes.
And three of these were about the Higgs boson.
About the Higgs boson.
Which is the smallest particle, temporary particles, which up and down just 1 second after the Big Boom. And they built for years this big accelerator.
To try and detect it.
That can be considered a kernel, because it's the smallest temporary part of the full universe.
For the time being.
For the time being, sure.
To our current scientific understanding.
The funny thing is that we have seen for 2 or 3 evenings movies about the preparation and interviews to the scientists about this really incredibly small thing, and they've spent, I don't know, 500
billions
for creating this big accelerating thing. And in the end, something that you cannot see, you cannot test, they just have.
But for them, it's important.
Between a small gap of possibilities.
Yes. But for them it's important because they consider this is the whole base of the physical world, no, of this universe that we live in.
Basic building block.
That's what they call the basic building block, yes. So there it's very interesting, if you remember what we read in the beginning of The Kingdom of the Little Life, about these basic building blocks, things that are coming into existence just for a moment and then disappearing again. They are, in a way, the base. But what's the real base is what is not, what can't, is not detectable by our aided sense. That when Aswapati tracks things really to their source, he finds there a present, a mystic present, from which everything is emerging, including the Higgs boson.
In those films, they show, they've done research, all of this is physics. And then they out of all of these numbers and everything, a standard model of the universe, and it sort of is on the screen for a moment, then disappears. And it's the mother symbol. There are 12 units around, then there are four categories, and in the center will be the Higgs
boson.
One thing that's holding all
this holding together. Everything together. How nice.
Yes, they call it God particle.
The what?
They call it God particle.
They call it the God particle.
I'm sorry?
He said this particle, the Higgs boson particle, they call it the God particle because it's holding everything together. But what we should realize is that our physical instruments and our reason are leading us to that very borderline between the material world and the subtle world. And the material world is just like a kind of skin on the outside of this immense range of subtle worlds. And we might remember that Shobindo has said, what are these worlds? Where are they? They are in us. They are all within us. And that's why Aswapati is able to go within himself to start his journey of exploration through all the subtle world. And now he's in the little mind, with reason. But what is the consequence for us? That's very interesting what he tells next. Turiya, did you read? Will you read?
An ancient wisdom fades into the past. The age's faith becomes an idle tale. God passes out the awakened thought. An old discarded dream needed no more. Only she seeks mechanic natures, interpreting stone laws inevitable. She digs into matter's hard, concealing soil to unearth the processes of all things done. A loaded, huge, self-worked machine appears. To her eyes, eager and admiring stare, an intricate and meaningless engineering of ordered, faithful and unfailing chance. Ingenious and meticulous and minute, it brought unconscious, accurate device, unrolls an unerring march, maps a sure road. It plans without thinking, acts without a will, a million purposes, serves with purpose none, and builds a rational world without a mind. It has no mover, no maker, no idea. Its vast self-action toils, a lifeless energy, irresistibly driven, death head on the body of necessity, engenders life and fathers consciousness, then wonders why all was and whence he came.
Thank you. Would you like to read?
Our parts of immense machine are wandering, but a freak of matter's law. The mystery lords was a fancy or a blind. Our soul, our spirit, we have now no need. Matter is admirable reality, the patent, unescapable miracle, the hard truth of things, simple internal soul, external soul, this a societal rush expenditure, treating the world by the mystery of the self-loss. As all its scattered work, later shall the self, disintegrating force, contract the immense expansion it has made, then end this mighty and unmeaning toil. The void is left bare, weakened as before. Thus, vindicated, crowned the grand new thought, explained the world and mastered all in its law, touched the dumb root, woke, waved tremendous powers. I bound it bound to service and unconscious digins,
jinns.
That sleep unused in matter's ignorant grace. All was precise, rigid, undue.
End. indubitable. And we'll stop there, we'll stop there. All was precise, rigid, indubitable. The materialist dogma. And our thoughts are just parts of this immense machine. The fact that we think and wonder, it's just a freak of matter's law. The mystics' law, what they told us, the ancient knowers and seers, it's just a fancy, or it's meant to deceive us. Now we don't need soul or spirit. We have no need. Matter is the reality, patent, inescapable miracle. Of course it is a miracle, but whether it's the soul reality is another thing. The hard truth of things, simple, eternal soul. And then he speaks about this doctrine of entropy, you know, that our universe has come into existence by this suicidal, rash expenditure, creating the world by a mystery of self-loss, has poured its scattered works on empty space. It's a nice evocation of the Big Bang. And late, after a long time, they say, this self-disintegrating force which has spread itself out like that and which is spreading more and more and disintegrating more and more, it will start to contract the immense expansion it has made. And it will go on contracting until everything is gone to a big black hole. Then ends the mighty and unmeaning toil. The whole thing has been absolutely meaningless. The void, the original emptiness, is left bare, vacant as before. Thus vindicated, justified, crowned the grand new thought, explained the world and mastered all its laws, touched the dumb roots, woke veiled tremendous powers, electricity, nuclear fusion and fission, all these tremendous powers. It bound to service the unconscious jinns, the powerful spirits which are sleeping unused in this ignorant trance of matter. So everything is worked out. All was precise, rigid, indubitable. Can't be questioned. There's no doubt about Dali.
But when on matter's roughest ages, base, a wall stood up firm and clear-cut and safe, all staggered back into a sea of dirt. This solid scheme melted in endless flux. She had made the formless power inventor of form. Suddenly she stumbled upon things unseen. A lightning from the undiscovered truth startled her eyes with its perplexing glare and dug a gulf between the real and known till all her knowledge seemed an ignorance. Once more, the world was made a wonder web, a magic process in a magical space, an unintelligible miracle's depth whose source is lost in the ineffable. Once more, we face the blank unknowable.
So let's stop there. Once more, we face the blank unknowable. Nothing seems sure. This is perhaps the discovery of quantum energies. Reason comes into contact with the formless power which gives rise to all forms. Reason suddenly stumbles upon things that are unseen, invisible. Well, that's like a flash of lightning which shows a gulf between the real, what seems real to us, and the knowledge which has been revealed to us. It's very, very confusing. People are trying to make sense of all this. But I remember my beloved teacher Amal telling me what is needed to explain these new quantum discoveries. It's not a new theory, it's a new consciousness. Because really the way they explain it is ununderstandable, unless you're tricking yourself all the time. Once more, the world, or all her knowledge, all the knowledge of wisdom, seems an ignorance, which of course it is. Once more, the world was made a wonder web, an incredible weaving together of miracles, a magic's process in a magical space, an unintelligible miracle's depths, whose source is lost in the ineffable, in what cannot be explained. Once more, we face the blank unknowable. The mind faces. That is what Professor Aurobindo Basu told us and showed us from Sri Aurobindo's writings. The unknowable is unknowable to the mind, but it can be known if we go beyond mind. That's what he shows Asvapati doing in Book 3.
But when on matters rock of ages based, a whole stood up firm. So a whole is the subject of this sentence. A whole meaning a complete.
A complete theory of everything. Yes, I think that's what he's talking about. They thought they had everything worked out. And of course, it happens again and again in the history of science. They think they have it all worked out and just a couple of steps further and it will all be clear. There'll be a grand unified theory of everything. But then something unexpected happened. Who said?
Einstein.
Who?
Einstein.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, he was a very, very wise man. And of course, that's the mark of the real scientists, the really great scientists, that they say, whatever we've discovered, we're just like little children playing with pebbles on the shores of an infinite ocean. That's really the mark, not the people who say, we've got it all worked out, this is it.
Even in Sri Aurobindo's yoga, when he started on it, he would write letters about being here for a short time and then going back to the brain, and he said, oh, this will take about this long, and then when he gets to that point, oh no, this will take much longer.
He's
just aware of it in himself.
Right. We can read a little further, Manoha.
Once more, we face the blank unknowable. We crash the body in a huge bull crack. In the sputter and scatter of her breaking world, she lost her clear, self-constructed world. Quantum dance remains, roll of chance in energy's stupendous shifting will. Ceaseless motion in the unbounded void, invented forms without a thought or aim. Necessity and cause were shapeless ghosts. Matter was an incident in being's flow, low by the clockwork habit of blind force. Ideas, ethics, systems had no base, and soon collapsed, all without sanction, need. All grew a chaos, a heave and clash and strife. Ideas worrying and fears leaped upon life. The heart compression held down anarchy, and liberty was only a phantom's name. Creation and destruction wars in arms on the bosom of a torn and quaking earth. All reeled into a world of callous dance. Dust tumbled, sinking, sprawling in the void, clutching for props, a soil on which to stand. She only saw a thin atomic dust, the ray of force, sparse substratum universe on which floats phenomenal
things. Let's pause there. Let's pause there. I think he's evoking the social consequences of this collapse of reason.
I think he's referring to quantum theory and quantum mechanics.
Yes, but it had an effect. The fact that everything that that reason had told us is suddenly shown to be shaky at the least, was reflected, we can say, was reflected in the in world history.
Isn't that why mind and reason clings so rigidly and strongly to us?
Yes, because that's the only certitude.
Yeah. What happens when that
is on.
Yeah.
I'm struck by one of the lines we read a little ways back.
Yes, Larry.
Death had on the body of necessity. And it was interesting that he put death like that, and death played such an important role later on as representative of, you know, a kind of point of view when he argues with savagery, and he kind of argues some of these points of science, and
yes.
After all, it's nothing.
you know, after all, everything comes back to me.
Yes. Yes, what is this death's head? You know, it is that the world, what seems to be at work is what he said, disintegration, no? Entropy. Everything's disintegrating. And it's twinned with this principle of necessity, things that have to happen, that are somehow predetermined or fixed and can't be changed. And it's a very interesting theme which surfaces again and again through the poem, is this interchange, balancing, interaction of what is necessity and what is chance, what has to happen and what seems to be unpredictable and unpredictable, unexpected. Yes, Paula.
The dilemma I have comes with this line: ideals, ethics, systems had no base and soon collapsed or without sanction lived. Mm. Because it seems like in our world right now, so much of what we see and do are involved and involves corruption, unethical behavior, really dark. The dance is really quite dark. And so when one takes a step forward to say, you know, well, here is a guideline, here is an ethical stand that you could take in the face of corruption, in the face of unethical behavior, you could try this. But this is almost saying, it doesn't matter. It's in a collapsed state anyway. Mm-hmm. So this ideal, these ethics are...
All these things on which our social development over the centuries has been based, if those are no longer valid, then you get a world like the world we see around us today. So we need a whole new set of certainties, of values. Yes, sir.
Yeah, what you were saying, this is spot on, what you promote. It's just we're burnt out, so to speak. The human, this, the life on this planet,
And what Sri Aurobindo says, this happening, this bankruptcy, is actually a sign that we have to find a new way. You know, this is the big opportunity. This is humanity at the crossroads. You know, Karan Singh spoke about that. He says it's even a promise. Sri Aurobindo says it's even a promise that something new not only needs to come but will surely come. Doom is the ultimate disaster. Doom. It's actually the end of the world. Doom's day. It's the day when the whole world collapses.
The doom crack.
Yeah, the doom crack. That's what it is, no? This whole universe is just going to burst apart. And of course, according to the traditional view, then the great judge will be there and will be deciding who's going to move into a new world and who's going to be finished off in a very unpleasant manner. That's the picture of doom. Sorry?
Where is that doom, that description?
I think it's in the book of Revelation, in the New Testament, the day of judgment. It's been built upon, of course, by the religious over the years, over the centuries. So what? Sorry.
The Aurobindo says, the hour of God, if you're not ready, analogical thoughts, that doom ideas have to prepare themselves.
So, let's stop there for today. Thanks to Sri Aurobindo.